session. Thanks for coming to listen to something about Serampore. Just to, you know, you always make excuses for a paper, but I hope you get away with it. But this paper was supposed to be presented by Dr. Marina Behera, who is Professor of Ecumenical Missiology at the Ecumenical Institute, Chateau de Bossy, Switzerland. And she... Okay, Dr. Behera had anticipated coming to present her own paper, and only about 3 weeks ago she wrote in and said, I'm very, very sorry, but both my time schedule and my budget don't allow me to come across. And so she sent the paper, and we thought it would be good for us to discuss the paper, even though she's not here. I did do a paper myself on... not Serampore College, but the founding of the Serampore community a little while ago. And I thought it might be a good idea just to try and intermingle those two papers. So if it sounds a bit disjointed, it is because I'm taking bits out of two papers. And I hope that I can answer to my paper, but I can't answer to Dr. Behera's paper. In less than a decade, the Serampore College will be celebrating 200 years of its existence. In this time, it has witnessed what is today called the First War of Independence of 1857, which began from the military cantonment in Barrackpore, which is located across the River Hooghly, opposite the college. It's seen the territories of the British East India Company being taken over by the Crown, the advent of the railways in India, the struggle for freedom, India's independence in 1947, globalisation and the liberalisation of the Indian economy, and the various acts of terror that make up a considerable portion of newspaper headlines today. What makes this coming event remarkable is that the college as it stands today and all that it stands for represents perhaps the most enduring legacy of the three missionaries who had founded the college: William Carey, Joshua Marshman, and William Ward, together known as the Serampore Trio. You will know William Carey as the father of modern missions, the shoemaker, who God led to do some incredible things. This paper will attempt to examine, and this is Dr. Behera's paper, will attempt to examine briefly, firstly, the objectives with which the college was established, secondly, the ecumenical nature of the college, and thirdly, some of the programs that the college carried out, and fourthly, lastly, what implication our examination of these events hold for us as Christians as we examine and advocate vulnerable methodologies of mission today. In the beginning of 1816, seems a long time ago, doesn't it? 1816, the Serampore missionaries proposed to build at Serampore a college of Eastern, Western, and Biblical learning. On the 15th of July 1818, they issued a prospectus for a college. Excuse me. For the instruction of Asiatic children and other youth in Eastern literature and European science. Sanskrit and Arabic were to be taught in view of their basic relationship to Islamic and Hindu literature, but emphasis was to be laid on the vernacular language. English language and literature were to be taught, since it was through that language that the world of scientific and Western ideas could be understood. It was to be a college that would also provide higher education to the poor, who otherwise had no access to college of any sort. It seems to me that's a fairly wide remit. It's very clear that the Serampore missionaries, for the Serampore missionaries, propagating the gospel in India was very important. And it was so important that those who were to be entrusted with this task not only had to be properly and systematically trained, but it also had to be done in an institution that had impeccable credentials. So they were therefore the best. The objectives of the college, when considering the establishment of a college that would train people so that Christianity would be effectively preached in India, Carey wrote to Ryland, the BMS secretary in England, in 1817, said this: "The work of duly preparing as large a body as possible of Christian Indians for the duties of pastors and itinerants is of immense importance. The pecuniary resources and the requisite number of missionaries for the Christian instruction of Hindustan's millions can never be supplied from England. And India will never be turned from her idolatry to serve the true and living God unless the grace of God rests abundantly on converted Indians to qualify them for mission work, and unless by those who care for India these be trained for and sent into the work. In my judgment, it is on native evangelists that the weight of the great work must rest." And I hope we could have a loud amen to that in mission to, direction. The objectives were stated as three. One, to train up pious youth for the Christian ministry. Two, to augment the biblical knowledge of such as are already employed in preaching. And thirdly, to enable those who had lost caste and were reduced by negligence to maintain themselves. I'm not quite sure the meaning of that phrase. I think there's a bit of Indian English coming into that, so I'll repeat it and then you can interpret it for yourself. To enable those who had lost caste, I think that's clear, and been reduced, or I put been in, and reduced to negligence by to maintain themselves. I think it's a little bit that they're left on their own, I think is probably the the answer there. Just as a little aside, I was hearing somebody, my experience of India is very limited, but I was hearing someone speak about it just last weekend, and I'm astounded just how strong the caste system still is in that country, in that subcontinent. In their report of 1819 to the BMS, they explained the difficulty foreign missionaries had in learning the language of the local population, and also many of the practical and health problems that missionaries faced. And I think this actually is quite relevant for us in thinking about our mission. And it's a little old English, but that's not to worry. From what treasury could places of worship be built all over India? And if they existed, who could persuade the heathen to enter them? But the native preacher under a tree, or even in the open air, can address his countrymen for hours together without feeling more fatigue than what attends similar labours in England. He can also find access to his own countrymen, and which Europeans cannot have to the lower orders of his own countrymen. In every place he can subsist on the simple produce of the country. He can find a lodging in almost any village he may visit, and he knows the ways to the hearts as well as the heads of his countrymen without difficulty. The European cannot travel without carrying along with him his food, and that wherein he may sleep, as there are no public inns, and hence a boat or a palanquin are quite necessary. Thus the expense of travelling to a European is very considerable, while the Hindu preacher, subsisting on 10 shillings a week, including travelling charges, will find that amply sufficient to carry him all over the country. Nor ought the expenses of giving to the English missionary an education, his outfits, his passage money, and the large salary he requires there to maintain him, to be forgotten in the comparison between a native and a European missionary. Well, bearing in mind that was written 200 years ago, I think that's quite foresightful in this presentation. They were convinced that the most economical and efficient method of filling India with missionary labels was that adopted in apostolic times, of employing those converted in a non-Christian country to publish the word of life to their perishing countrymen. They reported how out of their 26 mission stations at that stage, 8 were occupied by brethren sent from the West, and 18 by brethren raised up in India. And bearing in mind that's within the first 20 years of their ministry, that's very encouraging, isn't it? And I think there's a lot in that. The second aim of the college, to augment the biblical knowledge of such as are already employed in preaching. The missionaries pointed out how it was important that such people be educated as well as equipped for the Christian ministry when they interacted with the local population, either as pastors or itinerants. You could almost summarise some of this as nothing but the best, can't you? And they really wanted to make sure that people were well trained and well equipped. It was also hoped that this would compensate their problems because they were perceived to have lost their caste. Let me come back. I've highlighted the wrong place. The third aim is to enable those who had lost caste and reduced to negligence to maintain themselves. It was perceived that to have lost their caste caused them problems, but this education would help in the removal of opinions among the other Indians that Christians are those who have sunk the lowest amongst all castes in vice and ignorance. If they're educated, they prove themselves. And in another part of the paper, Dr. Behera comments how very often the Christians are seen as the lowest of the low, and they're treated that way. It's a problem in India, isn't it, at the moment, because there's so much emphasis from Christian missions with the Dalits, who are the non-caste people, below the bottom caste, that the church is growing amongst the Dalits, and other people are actually turning around and saying, one minute, that's nothing to do with us. But that's another issue, perhaps, to be discussed. The college was also set up with an ecumenical nature, so that the council of the college always had at least one other person of another denomination other than Baptist. The professors and tutors of the college, there were some from outside of the Baptist denomination. And it was open to anybody who had the qualifications to teach. Education for Christians of all denominations. The college was open to members of all denominations of Christians and to as many heathen scholars as chose to avail themselves of its exercises and lectures, provided they maintain themselves and pay for themselves. Education for Christian non-Christian youths. Although the main aim of the college was to train a body of Indian preachers who would efficiently and effectively preach the gospel in India, the missionaries had a vision and a hope that even non-Christians would avail themselves of the education that the college would provide by payment of fees. The charter of the college also guaranteed that no caste, colour, or mode of belief would be considered a barrier to anyone wishing to study at the college. And then they intended to have a practical approach to the college, considered it more advisable for the Christian young people, is it more advisable that they should be trained up in association with those who they were destined for secular work? In other words, they didn't want to separate out the Christian young people and the non-Christian young people. They reckoned that if they grew up with those who were, that they were going to be working with and evangelizing, they'd learn how to deal with them. They would then be more likely to obtain that knowledge of the character, the feelings, and the prejudices of the non-Christians among whom they were designated to labour by freely mixing in the general society of a college. Do you ever worry that we get lost in our ivory tower sometimes and we don't properly mix with people with whom we work? Degrees conferred. The charter granted the college the power of conferring degrees, and they were conferred either in divinity, law, or science. And it should be free of all charge to the individual on whom it may be conferred, in whatever part of the world he may reside. And the college programs, one or two interesting points in the programs. And this paper will be emailed to you, so where I've slipped over things, you can have a look in more detail. They, alongside their Edward, they established a lot of auxiliary grammar schools and preparatory schools, where its education was a very big push. They also had a class of European habits, which I thought was an interesting thing. This was for theology students. And this actually was established, it says the formation of this class was enforced by the necessity of preparing missionaries in the country to avoid the almost overwhelming expense of missionaries educated in Europe. And I was fascinated by that, so I wrote to Dr. Behera and I said, do you mean then that what they did is they brought people from Europe to India to be trained as missionaries in India? And she said, this class was entirely for Europeans. An interesting thought, isn't it? When you think of the expense of some of our Bible colleges and training colleges in the West, a lot cheaper to do it there. Then they had what they called the native class for the science and arts, and they had an emphasis on the Indian language and especially on Sanskrit. Now, are any of you Asian-orientated? It was Andrew who's more... You're more Asian. No. But I understand that Sanskrit as a language is a very fundamental language for all of the Indian languages. So that was why they insisted on Sanskrit being the basis.
The Latin of India.
Yes, okay, that's fair enough. Good. Yeah, thank you. The missionary's emphasis on the teaching of Sanskrit at the college was primarily in recognition of its strategic importance for learning and understanding Indian vernaculars. It may also have been a declaration that the sacred language, hitherto the preserve of the elite, should be available to everybody. And then the attitudes of the college towards local culture and language. They believed that Christian Indians should be able to debate with the learned men of Banaras, the present-day Varanasi and Uttar Pradesh, on equal terms. Christians are not down here. They've got the intellect, they've got the ability to really communicate. However, we should not forget that the reason Indian Christians had to be conversant with the customs and language of Bengal was that they might more effectively propagate Christianity. For the Serampore missionaries, it was a matter of transforming rather than replacing local culture with the language, learning, and cultural expertise as a means to an end. There is a very important statement, isn't it? That it was a matter of transforming rather than replacing the local culture with the language, learning, and cultural expertise as a means to an end. That's vulnerable mission, isn't it? It's transforming, not replacing. And then they also had an emphasis on education for children of Christian parentage and educating the children of missionaries so that the missionaries could get on with their job without worrying about their children's education. That's an important thing, isn't it? One of my sons-in-law is a principal of an international school in Indonesia for missionaries' children. So their work is looking after the children, training them and educating them so that parents can get on with the mission work that they have been called to. It makes a big difference, even in the secular world. When I was living in Malawi, I came to Malawi at a time when Dr. Banda was just, he'd only been president for a short period of time. He was working out his way of doing things, and he wanted expatriates who were prepared to train. He had a whole host of expatriates, colonials, in his civil service who were there because that was their job and they were there for life. And that didn't suit his purpose. So what he did was he actually failed to renew the work permits of the old people but brought in new expatriates to take their place. But younger people who were then keen and prepared to train they're only coming for a few years for experience. But those young people, younger people, were going to be people who had children and who were going to worry about their children's education. So the president set up a completely different series of schools for expatriate children, based on the British system, so that the people he was going to employ could come from UK, mainly UK but other places, come from UK, bring their children, and they would move seamlessly into a UK-based and quality school. And when they left, they could go back into the British system. That's forethought, but it's showing the importance of children and family. And actually, that's something we one of our groups talked about last night. We didn't bring up into the debate about the importance of family and vulnerable mission for missionaries. Anyway, I digress. The educating Christian missionaries. And then we have this section where Dr. Behera is trying to emphasise the implications of Serampore College for vulnerable mission. And both Jim and I, on reading the paper, realised that Dr. Behera has slightly different concepts of vulnerable mission than we have. And she has some complaints against vulnerable mission, which is fine. And this I will intersperse in a minute from my own paper. This brief study of the reasons behind the establishment of Serampore College has shown us what its objectives were, its ecumenical nature, and we also looked at some of the programs the college ran or planned to do so. Considering the time of its establishment, the general attitude of the colonising powers towards their territories and the local inhabitants, it is safe to assume the Carey, Marsh and Ward, the Serampore trio, were ahead of their times in considering the local population as equals and wishing for them as contemporary and useful as contemporary and useful an education as could have been possible at the time. Our brief study also reminds us that the participation of the local population is vital if we're to carry out mission using vulnerable mission methodologies. Indeed, when we look at the mission strategy behind the establishment of Serampore College, the Serampore trio acknowledged that ultimately the task of proclaiming the gospel in India will have to be done by the Indians themselves. Can I move now into... I'll come back to Dr. Behera's paper in just a minute, but I want to just go back in time to the establishment of the Serampore community. When you get the paper on the email, my paper is called Thoughts on Missionary Support. I invite you to ignore the first half of it, because that is really just a personal spiel about the way in which God has worked in my life in this area and some of the thoughts I had on that. That's not quite so relevant. If you can read it, it's an interest, but it's not relevant to what we're doing now. But now we want to talk about the way in which Carey had in mind to set up the Serampore community. Before he went to India, in fact, in that that book, have you all read his inquiry? Because it's a fascinating and very, it's a seminal booklet really, written before he'd been on the mission field. Written when he was just looking ahead to see what could be there in situations which were completely unknown to him. And in his theorising, this is what he had to say about the way missionaries would go. It might be necessary, however, for two at least to go together. And in general, I would think it best that they should be married men, and to prevent their time from being employed in procuring necessaries, two or more other persons with their wives and families might also accompany them, who should be wholly employed in providing for them. In most countries, it would be necessary for them to cultivate a little spot of ground just for their support, which would be a resource to them whenever their supplies failed. Not to mention the advantages they would reap from each other's company, and it would take off the enormous expense which has always attended undertakings of this kind. the first expense being the whole. For though a large colony needs support for a considerable time, yet so small a number would, upon receiving the first crop, maintain themselves. They would have the advantage of choosing their situation. Their wants would be few. The women and even the children would be necessary for domestic purposes. Slave labour? And a few articles of stock, as a cow or two and a bull and a few other cattle of both sexes, a very few utensils of husbandry, some corn to sow their land would be sufficient. Those who attend the missionaries would understand husbandry, fishing, fowling, and be provided with the necessary implements for these purposes. Indeed, a variety of methods might be thought of. Once the work is undertaken, many things will suggest themselves to us of which we at present can form no idea. So you see what he had in mind. Not a committee sending out an individual and continually supporting that individual in their mission work, but a small community going out which became self-sufficient, looking after themselves. Now, times have changed a lot since then, but there could be some things in that which we can think about as part of our mission and part of our own mission exercise. We assume that Carey had in mind the missionaries would not, after an initial settling in phase, be dependent on financial support from UK, but would set up as a small community, caring for their own needs in much the same way as local folk would. Indeed, some members of the community would have their major commitment as providing for the frontline missionaries, so that the frontline missionaries, could get on with the missionary endeavour. It's true they had some false starts over this in India, and had to be bailed out by the UK committee on different occasions, but eventually the Serampore community functioned very well, very much as a self-supporting community, enabling fresh funds that were raised by the UK committee to be used in sending out new missionaries. Dr. Usoran, well, that's how I pronounce it, doesn't quite look like that. Dr. Usoran comments on the beginnings of Carey's ministry thus: from the very beginning, he adhered to the convictions of the Moravians relating to the support of missions. And I don't know, do any of you have a lot of information about the Moravian missions? But they actually formed the basis of Carey's attitudes and his work. He quoted a letter to his sister on the 11th of March 1795, that it was always my opinion that missionaries may and must support themselves after having been sent out, and receive a little support at first, and in consequence pursue a very little worldly employment which requires 3 months closest attendance in the year, but this in the rains, the most unfavourable season for exertion. There is a certain amount of pragmatism about Carey in his approach there. It's clear that he did actually adhere to his principles. On the 20th of January 1820, Carey reminded the Baptist Missionary Society committee that the ideas under which he, Carey, came forth respecting the manner in which foreign missions can alone be supported to a sufficient extent are by no means unknown. They were that whatever help brethren might need in the beginning, they should as soon as possible support themselves, meet all their necessary expenses, and of course manage their own affairs, cooperating with their brethren at home in forwarding the common cause to the utmost of their power. Carey and his friends initially said they wanted to live in 6 primitive mud huts as a community. It didn't work out like that. They weren't able to do it. But they did live together in a large house in the middle of town. This was governed by a set of rules which committed them to a large degree of transparency and openness, both within the community and to those who they sought to serve. And I would love to actually be able to do more study on that community and the way in which they lived together. Reading various books on the issue is fascinating. When I was in Malawi, I was in a way a lone missionary, Working with Script Union, we were the only Script Union staff at that stage. But in Blantyre, where we lived, there were a number of other missions with groups, with what we would call mission stations, with larger groups of missionaries. And we actually served as a bolt hole for many of these missionaries, because they wanted to just get away, and you know, kind of the pressures of a mission station can be very strong, can't they? And they can cause a lot of problems. And that was the other side to this. In many places, this concept of mission station, which acted as a home and work for missionaries, was a natural development for Carey. It provided the possibility of producing food, which would be a resource to them whenever their supplies failed, and that last bit I read from the inquiries. Over the years, however, the self-supporting aspect of the mission station did get lost in many cases. In a number of more hostile situations, the mission station became essential for self-protection and often was a factor in it becoming more closely related to the colonial powers, effecting a greater separation from the people for whom, who were they reaching out to. The negative side of the mission station. Robert Rees, in a book called Roots and Remedies. Have you, any of you read that? Roots and Remedies for Dependency Syndrome in the World Missions. It's a very, very good book. Have you read it? And it's very helpful. And he comments there that the willingness of Rhodes in Rhodesia to donate large tracts of missions actually blurred the differences between the settler and the missionaries in local people's eyes. It's interesting to compare this scenario, the mission station, with one described in the old Nyasaland, modern Malawi, by a man that I always think of as a maverick missionary, a man called Joseph Booth, who actually set up, I think, 7 denominations in Malawi. That's another, it's an interesting story. But here, in a tract that he wrote to Queen Victoria, which will tell you something about him, he commented on this. He said, "The native is quick to note the early statements of the missionary, that he's come to help the Africans. He believes and plods on. By and by, he sees goodly houses with snug surroundings and manifold conveniences. But almost likely enough, altogether, they were enjoyed by the Europeans. Whilst he gets a few crumbs of aid, generally not so much as he would from worldly employers, and begins to ask, is this help? Have they not come to help themselves?" Now, that was written back in the late 18th century. And that's quite challenging, isn't it? How do people see us? In a stark way, Booth comments enable us to think about how missionaries have been viewed, and in some cases still are, by those they have come to help. And I think this is a very crucial thing for us to bear in mind. How do people see us? Not how do we feel, and how do our supporters feel. Many of us have lived in other countries, could recount instances where missionaries from what I call the materially developed world, I'm very conscious of our Australian compatriots, and I don't want them to feel left out of being blamed, so don't use the West so much, I use materially developed world in my thinking. But many of us who have lived in other countries could recount instances where missionaries from the materially developed world have sought to reproduce the living standards they left behind in their home countries within their host country. We know of one mission where the main role of one of the missionaries was to ensure that new missionaries were able to move into houses in their host countries with all mod cons already in place, including the large fridge, the large freezer, the bread maker, and all of these things. And they had a list of things they provided for all of their missionaries. Large car, large 4x4. Yes, everything was to be ready for them just to slip seamlessly into. I was devastated when I actually heard her talking about it. The point at issue here, however, is not the disparity between the living standards of some missionaries and local folk, which is a real issue in itself, but the question of how were the missionaries financed. In this matter, there's not a lot of difference between the extravagant Western lifestyle of some missionaries and the more simple lifestyle of most of them. Where does the finance come from to keep them going in their daily lives? Their food, their clothes, their education, the children, and so on. To whom are the missionaries responsible for accounting for their financial affairs? Frequently, it's pointed out, the missionaries are not a drain on local resources. That's a fair comment. We don't take any money from the local people, so they're free. But all their needs are met by donations from overseas. But isn't this where we have shot ourselves in the foot? Local Christians have taken on responsibilities for different aspects of the church's life and have replaced missionaries from the developed world. It shouldn't surprise us that those new leaders look to the same sources for their support, i.e., in the materially developed world. They're taking over from these people. That's where their money was coming from, so why shouldn't my money come from the same source? In the scenario that Carey suggested and then lived out at Serampore, it was clear to local folk that the mission personnel were dependent on their use of local sources. The mission personnel were dependent on their use of local sources. Even if it was teaching and lecturing, as Carey and others did later. And Carey eventually actually got a very good income from lecturing at the universities. But he never used that for himself. It came into the work. And it was other people could see that he was doing what other people could be doing locally. And they could see that people could see that there was no great white benefactor overseas who was providing their funds. There's a precariousness in it. There's a vulnerability about this. Because when local sources dried out, as in famine or drought, the missionaries suffered in much the same way as the local folk. What better example of incarnational ministry can we think of? This is vulnerable mission. Missionaries supported themselves mainly from local sources, showed that God's work could be supported in this way, and would not be dependent on benefactors from the materially developed world who would supply all their needs. This meant when missionaries would leave, local people would look to local resources rather than to be unhealthily dependent on others. This dependence on local sources also makes a local accountability a possibility and could be a good point of a strong financial accountability once missionaries are no longer in the equation. If the local church has always known where money is coming from for its work and has control over its use, there will continue to be local pressure for good accountability. I'd love to hear from some folk who've got any experience in that area. Some of what I'm saying there, I admit, is theory. I'd love to see some people putting that in action. When I was working for SU in Malawi, I was responsible to and paid by the local SU committee. Initially, the vast majority of the money in the budget came from SU in Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And one of my responsibilities during the time there was to seek to encourage local folk to give to replace that money from overseas. The result of this was when we left, local giving was a significant factor, admittedly not the sole factor, in local staff being able to take over the work. There's a lot more we could have done. In many areas and ways, things have moved on from William Carey's time, but somewhere along the line, the concept of self-missionary communities seems to have been lost. There was a time when tent makers was a prominent theme in some mission circles, and still is in what were called the Can countries, Middle East countries. But the concept of tent makers at that stage was not so much a self-support. It was to be able to get into a country and to be able to minister as Christians within that country. Nowadays, tent making is often seen as a needs-must situation when funds run out, rather than a deliberate lifestyle to get closer to the people being reached, to be more accountable and to give an example to the local church. My parents were missionaries in Bolivia right through the war. And during the war, funds ran out. And so my father had to become a tent maker. And he actually worked on the railways for many of the years of the war. But that was a financial driven thing. But the question that I'm asking is, shouldn't we be thinking more about this in terms of every day, in order to get closer to people that we're working with, and not just to be seen that we're people who are dropped out of the sky onto them? The move to consider business as mission in recent years seems to be getting nearer to that sort of model, and I'm not going to go into the details of that now, largely because I'm not experienced enough, but that is an area which we might discuss. Perhaps a time of financial austerity is a good time to reflect on what Carey had in mind and think through what its significance was and how this might look in modern situations. So there's some thoughts on missionary support from that area. We go back to Dr. Behera's paper. Just one or two comments that she made in it, and then I'll hand over to you, Mike. Is that okay? Yeah, I will try and allow that. I'm sorry, we started a little bit late. This is what Dr. Behera says. How then does the rationale behind the establishment of Serambul College fit in with the strategies of vulnerable mission, where her understanding is the main idea is that without local participation, mission and developmental strategies, I'll say it again, without local participation, mission and development strategies will fail because outside money will not be used to support such mission endeavours. Slightly different from our idea of vulnerable mission, I think. But let me read that again, because this is what she's saying. How then does the rationale behind it, the college, fit in with the strategies of vulnerable mission, where the main idea is that without local participation, mission and development strategies will fail because outside money will not be used to support such mission endeavours? So she's making a critique there against our concept of vulnerable mission, I think. Vulnerable mission appears to presuppose that any mission endeavour or developmental work that is begun has sufficient resources in terms of capital, materials and trained personnel to begin the work strongly right from the start. Would such a presumption therefore be idealistic, when realistically almost all mission fields around the world that were established by foreign missionaries depended to a great extent on liberal donations from churches and mission organisations from the home country? Indeed, in the case of Serampore, she claims that the BMS supplied money from UK, and later on it was supported from Carey's salary. But I hope I've actually laid that one a little bit by actually pointing out that it was only for a short time they received money, and Carey provided from his own salary, but he was a local person doing it. It didn't bring it in from outside. She says, is vulnerable mission viable and effective in a country that has an economically as well as a socially and politically poor Christian population? I'll just repeat the question again, and then we can perhaps discuss that. Is vulnerable mission viable and effective in a country that has an economically as well as a socially and politically poor Christian population? Secondly, what are the implications of an emphasis on the use of local languages and local resources, especially in scenarios where communities, both Christian and non-Christian, may not have access to such resources in a free and fair manner? She's obviously thinking of the Dalit community and the lower caste in India. And then her third question, are vulnerable mission and development strategies that depend on locally available resources and local languages shutting the door to access to quality education that only the rich would be able to afford? So those are three questions that Dr. Behera would have produced herself, and they're for us to perhaps as a starting point to think through. Over to you.
Okay, a moment of different questions.
Yes, that is at the beginning of the paper. Is starts off with the concept that it's soon having its 200th anniversary. And so she was looking through the history of the college as it was set up. It is still there. It is still a viable college. It's a university college which has branches, I think, in a large number of Asian countries. It has spread its tentacles out.
And it's still working on the same ethos.
I would hope so. I have to say I'm presenting someone else's paper.
Yeah.
But my understanding is that it's working very much.
Shambo College is the standard for private universities in India, and most people, whether they're Christian universities or private universities, they go through Shambo Board at times to be accredited under them, and so they can get accreditation from the state. So academically, it's well recognized. It has a theological program which has, I think, about 120 students. That is the solid Christian core of the school. Because the rest of the student body is either Muslim, Hindu, a Marxist, and a scattering of Christians on the student body. Faculty the same way. The theological college has a Christian faculty, the rest a few Christians, mostly all other different groups. It is functioning as an academically sound institution. Does not have a real Christian worldview beyond the theological college. It did not penetrate the Catholic level, Christian worldview beyond the training of missionaries and ministers. Very basic facilities, many of them were built in the early 1800s, still there. Whether the house the missionaries lived in is now a Baptist church.
Right.
In town. And there are two historic churches in town, Baptist and Lutheran, the Danish Lutheran, and Baptist missionaries pastored that as well. I think one of the reasons why it succeeded was we carried him from old poverty. There's nothing to describe it other than just almost destitute poverty when he was a pastor. He was even poorer than family earlier. And he was able to accept a lifestyle that was very, very basic. On the other hand, and the first group of missionaries who came had that same education, a printer and school teacher. But by the 1820s, this new generation came in, asking about service. Eventually, Pellet Carey and the Sarah Porterfield, they split from Baptist England for a while and then rejoined. Part of that was that they just couldn't get along with this new group that wanted to have more luxuries and did not see the vulnerable mission.
One of them was Carey's nephew, wasn't it?
Well, yes, he was. He was a very difficult person. But anyway, I've read a lot about it,
yeah.
But that's okay. But I think if you Google Sarapour Covenant and just look at the covenant itself and the principles of it, no missionary should have any property that they would call their own. It's a community village very much like in the early church. And that's how we view missions. And I would say I've read it that way up until the late teens. But when they started getting reinforced, I remember reinforcements from
Have you been around the library in Regent's Park in Oxford? Because they have a Carey, they have a BMS archive, and in that archive there are many of the letters that he wrote. I've quoted from some of them in that letter, and it's fascinating to read. Can we welcome Mark?
Hi.
Hi, Mark. Mark Oxford. Just tell us who you are. When everybody's together, with the other half of it.
Yeah.
But tell us now. Thank you for that, John. I don't have the
Okay, well, thanks a lot.